I'm Tom Morello, and you're listening to the Ralph Nader Radio Hour.
It's the Ralph Nader Radio Hour.
Stand up, stand up. You've been sitting way too long.
Welcome to the Ralph Nader Radio Hour. My name is Steve Scrovan, along with my co-host, Hannah Feldman. Hello, Hannah.
Hello, Steve.
And the man of the hour, Ralph Nader. Hello, Ralph.
Hello, everybody. Oh, this book you're going to use immediately by Gene Carper.
Yes, today we welcome back medical journalist Gene Carper, who has written extensively on health and nutrition. We're going to talk about her latest book, 100 Life or Death Foods, a scientific guide to which foods prolong life or kill you prematurely. She's going to take us through the food alphabet from bananas to wine. We're going to skip apples. Apples have gotten plenty of media coverage already. So stay tuned to find out what foods Gene Carper recommends to prolong your life. As always, somewhere along the line, we'll check in with our relentless corporate crime reporter, Rosa Mokhiber. But first, let's do a little food shopping with an expert. Hannah?
Gene Carper is a medical journalist and wrote Eat Smart, a popular weekly column on nutrition every week for USA Weekend magazine, from 1994 until 2008. She's still a contributing editor, writing health and nutrition articles. Ms. Carper is also a former CNN medical correspondent and director of the documentary Monster in the Mind. She's the best-selling author of 25 books, mostly on nutrition and health. Her latest book is 100 Life or Death Foods, a scientific guide to which foods prolong life or kill you prematurely. Welcome back to the Ralph Nader Radio Hour, Gene Carper.
Thank you.
Welcome indeed, Gene. Listeners should know that Gene Carper's always been ahead of her time. She wrote a book many years ago called The Food Pharmacy, which some food scientists scowled at because it wasn't based on double-blind scientific studies. Of course, there weren't any in those days. And now there are a lot of studies, and they're all cited to back up her short chapter-by-chapter commentary on the kinds of food that will prolong your life and the kinds of food that would shorten your life. Gene, let me ask the first question here, because when you go into one category of foods after another that we're going to do in a minute, people are going to say, well, is that just her hunch? Is that just common sense? Or is it based in science? So what did you base your points when you talk about eggplant and berries and beans and legumes and cabbage and caffeine and calories, etc.? What did you base all this on?
Well, I wish you could see the number of file cabinets that I have here, in which I had all of these studies. What I do generally is go online, look for all the studies that I can find. I do a lot of research at the National Library of Medicine, which they have everything online these days. So I had at least five full drawers of articles, scientific articles, mostly by leading university scientists. Those are the places where they've been doing the most research on this subject. Because when I looked, I realized the reason I did the book, can I just tell you that? The reason I did the book was that I knew there is no other book like this. Nobody has taken a scientific look at all the studies that are being done on specific foods with conclusion as to how they are going to affect longevity. It is a totally new field. It really only has started several years ago where scientists were getting interested in this. And I thought of all the things that would be the most interesting about a food and whether or not you wanted to eat it would be, oh, how long does it prolong my life? Or on the other hand, is it likely to shorten my life? And that was the question that I asked of all the foods that I put in the book and I could find substantial scientific studies on.
Well, the interesting thing, listeners, is this book affects you all. We've often said with authors, you better listen, the military budget draining the public budgets affects you as taxpayers. Well, a lot of people aren't taxpayers. This one affects all eaters. And as Jean says in her introduction, quote, I have distilled this latest research to create a unique, up-to-date, one-step guide to more than 100 common foods, beverages, and popular diets, revealing whether they prolong health and life or accelerate aging and death. This is in her new book, 100 Life or Death Foods, a scientific guide to foods that prolong life or kill you prematurely. And she's been a New York Times best-selling author with her other books as well. Now, we're not going to be able to go through all 100, but we're going to go through several dozen because Jean speaks very concisely. And we want to whet your appetite for this book. And I'm pleased to say this is the first interview over the media on Jean Carper's new book. So let's start with the first entry. You have them all by alphabetical sequence. Let's start with bananas.
The fact of the matter is that bananas, surprisingly, and I did not ever know this before I started doing this research, bananas have a reputation of being very anti-cancer. And bananas are also the most popular fruit in the entire world. So it wasn't until 2022 that international scientists really discovered how incredibly strong anti-cancer bananas are, because they have something in them called resistant starch. And when they are broken down, you eat a daily dose of resistant starch in slightly green bananas. There's more of the anti-cancer activity in slightly green bananas than in totally ripe bananas.
Let's go to beans and legumes.
If there is anything in the world that people should be eating to try to live longer, it's beans, legumes, lentils, peas. And by the way, peanuts are in that category also. So what I found essentially was that if you eat a half to three quarters of a cup a day of any of these, you are going to cut your risk of dying of anything by about 16%.
Let's go to another category that might upset some people, beer.
Beer. I've never liked beer. So, however, the fact of the matter is that people don't really take beer as seriously as they should. Beer is an alcoholic drink, and many people just throw it down like it's a Coca-Cola or something, but it is not. And studies show that high beer consumption absolutely causes your death rate to soar. It's gone up as high as 24% in premature deaths, and is responsible in major cities for high death rates.
How about berries?
Oh, berries are super. If anything that everybody should be eating, it's berries. And one of the studies that I discovered is that blueberries, of all the berries, blueberries are the most powerful in keeping you alive longer. And they did a test. Well, they did a look at a study of 2 million women, and those who ate blueberries or more than only once a week reduced their death rate by one third. Now, that is powerful. And by the way, strokes, they reduced strokes by about 37%.
And now, when you say that, what does it mean actually reduce the death rate by a third?
Well, it means that if you looked at the ordinary death rate, whatever it is, and by eating these foods, you reduce your odds of dying by whatever the percent is. So nobody is going to live forever, so you're going to die sometime. You're just going to die later, at a later age. So you're going to live longer, and you're going to have a much, well, as I said, a much longer life.
Now, you have something called white bread is death's best friend. Tip-top bread. You know, the early breads that were almost 100% filling the shelves in the supermarket when I was a young person, Tip-Top bread and others. My mother would say that you could always see Tip-Top bread by looking the other way, picking it up in the supermarket and having your fingers and thumb collide. So tell us about white bread and increasing use of multi-grain bread. It's good progress here.
Yeah. White bread was certainly very popular when I was a child. And it's so amazing to me how recent some of these studies are. So So they didn't really know all that much about how bread was going to affect her longevity. But then it was a bunch of Canadian professors in 2021, and they did a landmark study. They studied the consumption of bread in 137 individuals in 21 countries. And what they found was really appalling. The more white bread you ate, the earlier you were probably going to die. So if you ate 7 slices of white bread a day compared to 2 slices a day, your death rate would jump up 27%. I think we should stop eating any kind of white bread like that and go to the alternative, of course, is fantastic because you go to whole grains. White bread is made from unrefined grains, and that's if they're so bad. But if you eat whole grain bread, your chances of dying are going to be substantially much lower. One study showed that if they started eating the so-called unrefined grains, that is whole wheat grains of any kind, the chance of cancer, for example, fatal cancer fell about 12%. So eat whole grain everything, and especially whole grain bread.
You have something called Blue Zones Diet, ideal for centenarians, people who are 100 years old or older. What's that about?
Well, that in the world, there are something called Blue Zones. And the Blue Zone is, it was thought up by an author. What he did was he went around the world and he found 5 longevity hotspots around the world. So he looked at their diets. He found one in Greece, one in Japan, one in Sardinia, Loma Linda, California, for example, and Costa Rica. And so the diet is mostly consists of a lot of plant food, minimal meat. In other words, the meat in the Blue Zone places are regarded just as a side dish. You would have 3 ounces of fish a week. You could have goat milk. You could have nut snacks. You could have no dairy, beans every day, natural sugars, sourdough bread. You could have coffee and tea in moderation. And that's a so-called Blue Zone diet that is in certain places, and it has been found to prolong life.
Here's an interesting one. One of my relatives has stopped eating breakfast. She heard somebody say it was good just to have one major meal a day, but you have a couple pages saying skipping breakfast brings death sooner.
Well, you know, that was a real surprise to me, Ralph, and that's one because who would have guessed? And I try to eat a little bit of breakfast, but sometimes I really don't eat enough or I skip or like everybody else. And so it was at Texas Tech University. These researchers looked at 7,000 middle-aged Americans, and they studied them. They followed them for 22 years, and they found that lots of them rarely ate breakfast, a few ate breakfast on Sundays, and 61% ate breakfast every day. Now, here's what they found. They were so shocked, and I'm going to read you the conclusion. Those who rarely ate breakfast were 50% more apt to die of cancer and 69% more apt to die sooner of anything than those who ate breakfast every day. That is a stunning statistic.
And you have something surprising. Caffeine, you say, keeps you awake and alive. That's not the general impression that it keeps you alive.
Yes, you're absolutely right about that. That was another big surprise to me. I'm not a really high caffeine consumer, but nevertheless, when I looked at the studies and the statistics, the fact was, well, in the first place, 64% of Americans drink caffeine daily. And the most striking study here was done at the University of California. And they found that Americans who consumed a typical 1 to 4 cups of caffeinated coffee a day were 10% less likely to die of anything than those who consumed a mere 50 milligrams. So that's another big surprise.
Well, this one shouldn't be a surprise. Calories overloads destroys longevity.
Yeah.
Explain.
Yeah. Well, because, you know, for so long, we've studied animals, and they've done a lot of studies on reducing calories in lab animals. And lo and behold, they find that in these studies, 30 to 50% of these animals lose weight, and it increases the animal's lifespan by 30 to 50%. So the reasoning is, if it works in animals, shouldn't the same thing work in humans? And sure enough, professors, especially at Washington University, they did studies on calorie restriction and longevity, and they did show for sure that restricting calories reduces inflammation, which is a promoter of aging, and that people who eat lots of calories are supposed to have heart functioning of somebody like 20 years younger, and restricting calories is a good way to prolong your life. Now, you have to be a little careful here. I mean, you have to be a little tricky. I wouldn't want anybody to go out and start cutting enough calories that they would be harmful to them, and that could happen. So I think that it would be a good idea, if you want to go on a calorie-cutting diet, that you should probably consult a dietitian or a doctor or some professional to be sure that you're not really hurting yourself rather than helping yourself.
Well, it makes a difference, doesn't it, whether they're empty calories, say, based on sugar, or they're calories fed by nutritional vegetables and fruits,
yes,
doesn't it?
Yes, and of course, they're lower in calories, and then you don't get candy. Candy is very bit. Candy is really high sugar, almost all sugar, and you get a lot of high calories. Yes, you're right about that.
Well, you're very favorable on carrots and celery. How about cereal?
Well, cereals, they're not all bad, but they're not all good either. And we have a lot of sort of ready-to-eat cold cereals. There have been studies showing that cereals can actually reduce your risk of death. And the National Institutes of Health did a big study of over almost 400,000 Americans, and it showed that those who ate the most ready-to-eat cereals compared to the least did reduce their death rates. However, when they started looking further, the fact is that when the University of Toronto researchers looked at it, they said it doesn't work unless the cereal is not refined. All the cereals must be whole grain in order to help you prolong life. So one of the studies showed that refined cereals, when the grain is demolished, actually raised death rates by 27%. But when they gave them whole grains, then their death risk was substantially reduced. So eat whole grain cereals. I mean, I was in the supermarket the other day looking at the aisles and aisles of cereal, and it's very depressing because there are so many of them that definitely you would not call health foods or life-extending foods. There are a couple of good ones. Fiber One looks very good for cereal. Very highest of all fibers. And my mother always loved shredded wheat, and we had a lot of shredded wheat as a child, and that still looks pretty good.
Well, the corporations who process these cereals have highlighted with huge ads for the kids cereals with a lot of sugar built right in.
You don't have to add it.
And oatmeal is still right up near the top, I take it.
Yes, oatmeal is my primary choice.
Another first for Jean Carper, she dedicated her book to her mother, grandmother, and great-grandmother. I've never seen that before.
They were three fabulous women, and they had a lot of influence on me when I was younger.
For sure. Chocolate, you say, superfood with a dark side. What do you say about that?
Literally. Well, chocolate is perplexing because the studies are kind of all over the place, and there was a recent study. It was actually a 30-year study of 27,000 men, and they ate about a half an ounce a day of chocolate compared to men who were eating none. And the ones who ate the chocolate actually did end up living about 12% longer. So there is something, and they know in chocolate that does extend life. However, there are also other not so good things in chocolate, and cadmium is very high in dark chocolate. So authorities don't recommend eating more than 1 or 2 ounces of dark chocolate a day, and milk chocolate is practically useless.
Here's coffee. This is a good one.
Coffee. I know, coffee. Who would guess? I'm not a big coffee drinker. I maybe drink a cup a day, but here's the first line of my section on coffee. Let me just read it. Coffee drinkers have a lower risk of death than non-coffee drinkers is the firm conclusion of a worldwide Harvard study of nearly 4 million subjects, and they just did this study in 2019. This is a very compelling study showing that there is something to coffee. And here's the good news, though. Even though we drink coffee that has caffeine, the fact of the matter is that researchers think it is the non-caffeine constituents of coffee that really are doing the work of making you live longer. So in the study, drinking half a cup of coffee cut death odds 5%, drinking a whole cup decreased odds 9%, and 2 cups a day sliced the death risk by 18%. Now, after that, drinking more, up to 7.5 cups, did not further increase longevity. So really, you don't have to drink a lot of coffee to try to increase your lifespan.
Well, let's go for the tea drinkers. What do you say about tea?
Tea is also one of those fabulous things that extends your life. Brewed tea, green, black, or oolong. Now, when you get to the kind of tea that many people drink, which is instant tea and bottled tea, that's not going to extend your life. They have very few antioxidants in them. So drink the real tea, brew the tea, and that will help you live longer.
What about eggplant, one of my favorite foods?
It is, really?
Yeah.
Eggplant? No kidding. Okay. I didn't realize how ancient eggplant is. And 4,000 years ago, in India especially, they used eggplant as a medicine. And they used it to treat diabetes. And actually, it has a bunch of recently discovered powers about it that no one realized until now. So, for example, if you look at 120 vegetables, eggplant was in the top 10 in antioxidant powers, and that's what you want. So I would say eggplant looks pretty good, though.
And then you have diet sodas. They kill you too, but faster.
You know, that was a surprise to me when I found it out. You would think, or at least I thought, well, the real thing must not be as good as these new diet drinks. No, well, I was totally wrong. They will kill you 3 times more quickly than the regular sugar drinks. So don't go for the diet drinks. They are just about one of the worst things that you could ever drink.
For the millions of people who have high blood pressure, what is this DASH diet you have in your book?
Oh, the DASH diet. Actually, the DASH diet is a very famous diet, and it's actually a famous blood pressure downer. The DASH diet is called the Dietary Approaches to Stop Hypertension Diet, and it's been a famous diet, and it was introduced in 1997, and it's been so effective, it's been proven as effective as blood pressure medications. And I mean, so many people die of high blood pressure. It kills 10 million people a year. And in 2023, this DASH diet was voted number one best diet by many researchers. So the DASH diet is you would have to eat every day 4 to 5 servings of whole grains, 5 servings of vegetables, 2 or 3 fruits, 2 low-fat dairy products, 3 servings of fish, poultry, or meat, 2 or 3 servings of unsaturated fats and oils. In other words, the DASH diet is very similar to the Mediterranean diet. And it's very good, it would be a very good idea to follow the DASH diet, especially if you have hypertension.
One thing that was interesting to me especially is your entry on fermented food, like pickles and sauerkraut.
Yes. Do you ever remember eating those? I grew up next to a pickle factory, of all things. So we had a lot of pickles, but this is fermented food, and it was very popular in ancient days with the Egyptians, Babylonians, Chinese. They preserved foods by fermenting them, and that meant exposing them to live bacteria. So they're not always the most popular foods with everyone, but the studies show that fermenting promotes longevity and has been shown to help prevent diabetes, gastrointestinal disorders, cardiovascular disease, cancer, and obesity. And when you think of it, if you can look at cabbage, for example, well, when you ferment it, it becomes sauerkraut. And when it becomes sauerkraut, it is said to triple its longevity activity. And it's very popular in the Japanese diet, all the fermented foods. And we know how the Japanese, their longevity is pretty darn good. And so I would say that fermented foods, and of course yogurt is a fermented food also, and it looks good.
I was looking at your entry on fried foods. You know, there is a regional difference in the United States. If you go down south and you go into restaurants, they really highlight fried foods, big time, fried chicken, French fries, etc. It's not that they don't highlight up north or west, but I think Southerners eat more fried foods. What do you got to tell them?
Well, okay, I'll tell you, you can tell what I think of fried foods by what I subtitled it. Everybody's fatal attraction. Fried foods are so bad for you. The fact is that there was a recent study, 20 years, of over 100,000 middle-aged women at the University of Iowa, and they concluded that eating fried foods every day raised the premature death average, specifically eating fried fiction, fried chicken, fried fish, or shellfish boosted death odds 12 to 13%, and a daily dose of fried chicken increase your risk from heart disease by 23%. So the more daily servings of fried foods women had in one study, the greater their risk of death increased. So fried foods are definitely one of the worst things that you can eat. And deep fried foods are really deadly.
Not surprisingly, Jean Carper, you're high on fruits and vegetables. And not surprisingly, you're high on garlic.
Garlic. Oh, my gosh. You know, it's one of the things that I forget to eat a lot. But, you know, for longevity, people ought to be eating at least a garlic clove a day. It's very good for you in prolonging life.
Does it make a difference whether it's raw or cooked?
You know, I started to say, I don't think so. But actually, I think it's probably slightly better raw, because so many things are slightly better raw. And my recollection is, yes, garlic is good either way, but probably slightly better raw.
Here's one of my favorites, grapes and raisins. And red grapes are better than green grapes?
Yeah, because of the color. And the intensity of the color often makes a difference. So the more intense that the skin of a fruit is, and actually, for the most part, in, a lot of fruits, like apples, etc., 50% of the longevity activity is in the skin. So whenever it's appropriate, try to eat the skin.
Wash the apple very thoroughly, though, as you suggest.
Yes, absolutely.
Herbs and spices. They can make nutritious food that isn't that delicious delicious. People don't make enough of it. People in India make a lot of it. What do you have to say about that in terms of longevity?
Tiny doses extend your survival. So use herbs and spices. And even if they're in tiny amounts, they are number one on the antioxidant potency. So they are extremely important. And so there was a major study, actually, by the National Cancer Institute, and they looked at 50,000 people over 11 years, and they found out that herbs delayed death. And turmeric, if you eat a lot of turmeric, you could expect to see your overall death risk go down maybe as much as 10%, according to these studies that the National Cancer Institute did. They also found that the death odds would drop by eating black pepper saffron, but the rates of death, overall death, down 15%, and also of heart disease. So even though you're eating a little bit of it, it's worth it. And also cinnamon, I forgot. Cinnamon is known for stopping the metastatic spread of cancer, which I didn't know before.
You have something on juices. A lot of people think if they drink grapefruit juice, orange juice, prune juice, that it's good for you. But we're not talking about fresh squeezed in your kitchen. You're talking about buying it in bottles, aren't you, from the supermarket?
Yes, that was a surprise to me. I was disappointed because it's so easy to drink juices instead of eating the whole fruit. But actually, the first line of my entry on juices is don't count on fruit and vegetable juices to help you live longer. It just doesn't happen. And the reason we know that pretty much is that there was a huge study done of 40,000 Americans just a couple of years ago. And the ones who said that they drank a daily cup or more of 100% fruit juice, and this was over like a decade, they actually were associated, their drinking of the juice was associated with a 30% jump in overall death odds and a 49% rise in fatal heart disease compared with drinking, you know, juice. Although this figure to me is shocking, it is based on really solid evidence. So don't think that you're getting by with drinking juice or that juice is any kind of substitute for the whole fruit.
You have something that's going to upset some people on cured meat, bacon, ham, hot dogs. You call them ferocious carcinogens.
Ralph, of all the things that I first discovered to be so horrible for you, bacon. I once did an entire article against bacon for a magazine because there is nothing, perhaps, in the entire world that can be any worse for you than bacon. Cured meats are absolutely death parcels, and bacon looks to be really, really the worst. The World Health Organization has called them blatant human carcinogens, eating any of those cured meats. And here's eating more than 5 strips of bacon a week, that's only 5 ounces, speeds up the arrival of death. And if you eat bacon, you are going to be earlier, 8% earlier of dying of heart disease, stroke, cancer, 9% more likely to get Alzheimer's, 12% more likely to die of diabetes, 19% to die of kidney disease, 21% respiratory diseases, and 22% from liver disease. So meat is hazardous on its own. Red meat is especially hazardous. But when you cure the meat, it doubles its likelihood of killing you. So ordinarily, if you ate 3.5 ounces of red meat, your death rate would go up maybe 9%. If the meat is cured with preservative chemicals, its odds of killing you soar to 17%. And from cardiovascular death, 19%. And neurodegenerative disease goes up, deaths from that go up 57%. And so the World Health Organization bluntly calls this a class one carcinogen. And they announced that, here's the quote, there is existing evidence. The existing evidence is sufficient to officially classify cured meat as a human carcinogen. So why are we eating it?
Yeah, well, it's a good question. You're very high on the Mediterranean diet, which doesn't have bacon at all, heavy on vegetables and fruits. That it's the core of my mother's recipes that we grew up on and that I put in a recent book, the Ralph Nader and Family Cookbook.
And I love that book.
Which has an introduction about how mothers and fathers can get their kids not to complain and whine at the dinner table and learn to love nutritious food.
If I could just say one more thing about the Mediterranean diet, because I don't think generally people know how powerful it is, but there was a study just 2023 where they looked at 700,000 American and European women, and the people who ate a Mediterranean diet, these women were 23% less likely to die. Their overall death rate were 23% lower. And at that time, the National Institutes of Health tried to get Americans on that diet, and they predict that if Americans would eat that Mediterranean diet, our death rates would go down about 20% in both men and women.
Well, fortunately, there are a lot of what they call Middle East restaurants spreading all over the country. And when we were growing up, they were very rare. So you can have more ready access. And also in supermarkets, you can buy hummus and baba ghanoush and other similar cuisines. You're high on olives, obviously, but you have a little skepticism on onions?
Well, I don't mean to have. There just wasn't. I was looking at that again. They just weren't looking as potent in preventing death as I remembered. So the current evidence was not as strong as I had hoped. That doesn't mean we shouldn't eat them because, I mean, they're an ancient food. I mean, ancient Egyptians, Greeks, and everyone ate them. And we still eat a lot of onions. Perhaps just to eat it. That maybe that recent studies have not been done. But Joel, there's no reason not to eat onions. I found absolutely nothing against them, but I didn't find as much for them in extended life as I would have liked to.
Gene Carper, obesity is becoming controversial. There's a defend obesity movement in this country, and there's some commercial involvement in the promotion as well. What do you say about obesity here?
Well, in the stuff that I looked at and the studies that I looked at, being fat is not a longevity booster. Now, that doesn't mean that if you go out and lose a lot of weight that you're going to live longer. On the other hand, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recently did a study. They looked at like 100 studies involving 3 million Americans who were obese, and their likelihood of death went up, was higher than normal by 18%. And if you were severely obese, your body mass, your BMI was over 40, your death risk soared even higher to 29%. And so it is a risk of death. Obesity clearly is not a health condition. And one study showed that death odds doubled after severe weight, whereas severe weight gain. And now it's also, I meant to say that you don't want a whole lot of fluctuation. And so even though you are likely to have, you could die from severe weight loss, you are much more likely to die from gaining weight. So it does not look good.
Some people listening say, I have to eat meat. I have to eat chicken because I need the protein. And you have a section called Protein, Plant or Animal, Deadly Difference. What's that about?
Yes, well, that's interesting because when people do talk about protein, they have to have protein. The fact of the matter is that you can get protein a couple of places. You can get protein from a steak, or you can get it from a cup of beans, and you would be far better off to get your protein from a cup of beans than from a steak. And I'm looking at a study, a Harvard analysis of the diet records of 130,000 men and women that they studied over 30 years. And what they found essentially was that eating plant protein promotes longevity, but eating meat protein promotes death. So of your choice, if you want to get protein, you would be far better off to get it from plant products than meat products.
Well, you're properly condemnatory based on the studies of salt and sodium in the diet. A lot of it comes in the processed foods, but still we have people adding salt from a salt shaker when they sit down to have dinner. Mike Jacobson, one of the founders of the Center for Science Public Interest, has written a book called The Salt Wars, and he estimates hundreds of thousands of people shorten their lives in the United States because of thought alone.
Yes, I would totally agree with that. And the latest study showed it. There was just a really huge study, the European Heart Journal last 22, and nobody will ever forget their message. Salt is a mighty killer, and you will live longer if you ban salt from your table. I am saying that because that's what the studies show. If you look, though, at Tulane University, they were doing studies, and they say that if you're always salting your food, your risk of premature death goes up 28% compared to people who never or rarely add salt. So salt is found to erase well over 2 years of life expectancy for men and women after middle age. So cut out the salt. There is a direct link between average sodium intake and death rate. No question about it.
Your studies show positively for brown rice compared to white rice. For soybeans, like tofu, miso, negative on sugary beverages. There's one for you. Fortunately, sugar beverages are declining compared to 20, 30 years ago.
Boy, and, I'm glad to hear that. I call sugary beverages killers on the loose.
Yes. On the other hand, you're very high on sweet potatoes. Why?
Because they're real food, and they are often... They are a very big part of longevity diet. They're really perfect food for people who want to get to 100 or more. And they're very famous in Okinawa. And they have, and Okinawa has more centenarians than any other place. So if you eat sweet potatoes, it's going to help you. They are a longevity food.
Studies you cite are high on the vegetarian diet. They high on tomatoes, especially cooked tomatoes, high on vinegar.
Yeah.
What about ultra-processed foods?
Oh, my. That's one of the worst. If we could get rid of ultra-processed foods, which we're never going to do, we would save so many lives. There are so many studies that show that ultra-processed foods are real killers, and these are international. There are studies everywhere. There are... studies in all countries, especially France and Australia and every place. And the worst study I ever saw was one in Brazil. And they attributed the death of 57,000 citizens for 10% of the population to ultra-processed food. And they said that that was the number that died by eating these ultra-processed foods. So why are we eating them? I mean, they are really terrible for you, and the studies are out there. They do kill people.
Vinegar studies show they extend life by the spoonful. People ought to use more vinegar as a taste enhancer as well, even though take it straight, it doesn't seem that way. You're down on Western diet. This is interesting, that less developed countries with their natural food over the history of their cultures are very often far superior to the so-called corporatized Western diet. Tell us how much responsibility do these corporations have? You've written over the years a lot of comments and articles on these corporate molesters of sound nutrition.
Yeah, it's really sad. Well, that's what it's called, sad, S-A-T, is a depression. And that's what we get from the Western diet. It's very sickening. It cuts your life short. And you know how generally the studies show that eating a Western diet can cut your life short by as much as a decade. It's very common because the diet is high fat, high calorie, high meat, high sodium, and everything that's bad with you. And the figures are that 11 million premature deaths a year happen to be linked to the Western diet. That is 11 million people who die with some relationship to a Western diet. So if you're eating a Western diet, my book shows you how to get off the Western diet and onto an optimal diet where you'll live much, much longer. If you switch, even at a late age, if you switch at age 60, you can gain in 8 years. And if you don't switch until 80, you can still live an extra 2 to 4 years by ditching the Western diet and going to an optimal diet.
Boy, the IRS should like your book, huh? Listeners should know this is a 200-page book. It's very readable. The print is very readable. It's very concise. It has these scientific studies at the end. Let's conclude with a skepticism on my part, because I'm not that informed. But these studies, you know, they say 15% increase, 8% increase, 10% decrease in life expectancy. What if you add them all up? I mean, what are the amounts? You know, they say 1,000% increase or 500% decrease. How does that work?
Well, the studies, they have their own way of doing these studies, and I've probably gotten quite used to them. And the people, I think there are many really good people doing these studies, and they do want to improve food. But all of the studies are rather done this way. I'm not saying everything is really great. But on the other hand, there are many people out there who don't want to eat this rotten food or this food that's going to kill you. They do want to eat the food. And that was one of the reasons I wanted to do the book, so people would know, at least on the science that I could find in reputable places, from reputable people who want to study this, that the fact is that there are certain foods who are more likely to save your life and more likely to kill you. And I wanted people to know the difference.
For sure. How do they do these studies? When you say they study 200,000 people, they have questionnaires or what?
A lot of the times they do have questionnaires. Sometimes they just get the people and they'll study them for 6 months and they'll say, eat this for 6 months, or eat this for 6 weeks, or eat this for a year, or do this, or stay off all alcohol, etc. Alcohol just doesn't look good at all. It's really terrible. 7.5 ounces of wine is no good.
How do they take into account what they call bias? In other words, if somebody eats consistently whole grains, they may have positive lifestyles.
Yes.
How do they take care of that?
Well, that is a very, very good, legitimate question, Ralph. And it is true that people who eat some of these things or do some of these things have other habits. Maybe they're non-smokers, they're whatever, they don't do this or that. That does influence their risk. So nothing is pure in this, but this is a way that they are trying to isolate certain things. And that's about the best that they can do, but it's not absolutely pure. And there are all these other factors that may enter in that are not taken into account. It's only a guess, but it's a better guess than we have with the studies than without.
Well said. And you're going to get some inquiries from our listeners who are more statistically oriented, and we'd like you to read them and respond to them.
Absolutely.
As only you can. Would that be okay?
Yes.
Now, you're going to open up a website. We've got an early interview with you before you have opened up a website. But in the meantime, people can get this book on Amazon, and it's in paperback, very easy to read. Could be a raging bestseller. I don't know anybody who cares about nutrition and health who wouldn't want this book, because it would immediately allow them to change their diet. They don't have to wait for some federal regulation. Immediately allow them to change their diet and extend their health, which would presumably mean extend their life expectancy. Steve and Hannah, you want to get in here?
Gene, I'm actually very happy to report I have a pretty good vegetarian whole grain diet, and I was running the numbers. I'm 67 years old. I'm going to live to 120, I'm very happy to report.
And that's great,
yes. Yes, I think that'll be a good thing. It may just be depressing. But the food I wanted to ask you about, food, it really wasn't food. And you may have covered this when you were talking about grapes, but I know wine has been controversial in this arena. And I'm talking about specifically red wine. What is your take on that? And please give me the answer that I'm looking for.
Well, I'm afraid it's probably not the answer you're looking for, because I myself always have thought for a very, very long time that a little wine was okay. I no longer think that. The fact of the matter is that the studies suggest that any amount of alcohol is not good for you. Now, if you are drinking wine, there is a limit per day that you should observe, because going past this will put you into a higher risk. 7.5 ounces of wine a day is probably the absolute maximum that anyone should drink of any kind.
All right. All right. I know that.
Because I occasionally drink wine, and I've virtually abandoned it now. I get a non-alcoholic wine, and I'm just fine with it.
I'm putting a little measuring line on my wine glass now at 7.5 ounces. Hannah, what do you have to say?
Well, first, I'd like to say my condolences, Steve. I'm sorry for your loss. I'm curious about the types of studies that you cite in your book. Are these lab studies? Are these case control studies? Are they meta-analyses? What kind of studies are we talking?
They're all legitimate studies that are published through National Library of Medicine, National Institutes of Health. That's where they all come from. So they're all there in some form or other, but the studies themselves are of every quality and every type you could think of. So they're all over.
They include animal studies, you mean?
Not very often. Most of the studies were human studies. You know, I think I maybe only quoted one or two animal studies, but the place I get all the studies, they're all indexed at the National Institutes of Health, at the National Library of Medicine. So they have to have some reason to be there. And most of them are done by reputable people who are studying this worldwide, a lot of academics, and some of them I recognize from studying all kinds of other stuff, and some I do not. But generally, it would be a higher quality than just going out on the street and yelling. Someone.
We've been speaking with multi-book author and medical correspondent Jean Carper, who for many years has been a major educational force on matters of food, health, and safety. She's the author of the brand new book, 100 Life or Death Foods, A Scientific Guide to Foods That Prolong Life or Kill You Prematurely. She's been a New York Times best-selling author, and we wish her the best of luck in this first interview of her latest book. Thank you very much, Jean Carper.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Jean Carper. We will link to her work at RalphNaderRadioHour.com. Now let's check in with our corporate crime reporter, Russell Mokhiber.
From the National Press Building in Washington, D.C., this is your Corporate Crime Reporter Morning Minute for Friday, May 3, 2023. I'm Russell Mokhiber. The Biden administration said last week it would again delay a decision on a regulation aiming to ban menthol-flavored cigarettes, citing the historic attention and immense amount of feedback on the controversial proposal by the Food and Drug Administration. This rule has garnered historic attention, and the public comment period has yielded an immense amount of feedback, including from various elements of the civil rights and criminal justice movement, said Health and Human Services Secretary Xavier Becerra. That's according to a report from CBS News. The White House had already overshot a previous self-imposed date to decide on the regulation by March. The rule had been stalled in an interagency review process. A senior administration official told CBS News they are asking for more time to hear from outside groups, especially on the civil rights side. For the Corporate Crime Reporter, I'm Russell Mokhiber.
Thank you, Russell. Welcome back to the Ralph Nader Radio Hour. I'm Steve Scroan, along with Hannah Feldman and Ralph. I want to thank our guest again, Jean Carper. For those of you listening on the radio, that's our show. For you podcast listeners, stay tuned for some bonus material we call The Wrap-Up, featuring Francesco DeSantis with In Case You Haven't Heard. A transcript of this program will appear on the Ralph Nader Radio Hour Substack site soon after the episode is posted.
Subscribe to us on our Ralph Nader Radio Hour YouTube channel. And for Ralph's weekly column, it's free. Go to nader.org. For more from Russell Mokhiber, go to corporatecrimereporter.com. Join us next week on the Ralph Nader Radio Hour. Thank you, Ralph.
Thank you, everybody. You'll want to get Jean Carper's book for your nutritional health and extending your life expectancy.
Hi, this is Jimmy Lee Wirt, and welcome to The Wrap-Up, where Ralph continues his conversation with Jean Carper.
Gene, I have to ask you, and I think Stephen Hanna would be interested, what's your latest take on the Alzheimer's industry and your documentary?
Oh, boy. Well, I don't know. I haven't heard much. I sort of lost touch with some of my people that I followed in my Alzheimer's documentary, and I really haven't tracked. I just don't know.
Is your documentary still available?
Yes, very much still available. I always liked the documentary a lot. Making a documentary was quite a change for me, and it took me 3 years, I think, to make it. Doing all the photography, the shooting, the editing, everything is quite a job. If I were much younger, I would do lots more documents.
Where can you get it? Online?
Yes. Well, you still can see it. I pull it up occasionally online.
And the title is what?
Monster in the Mind. I watched it like 6 weeks ago or something. I still like it.
They just withdrew another Alzheimer's drug, which proved to be ineffective.
Industry. It is. I didn't know they did, but I'm not surprised. I don't think they'll ever find an Alzheimer's drug. It's a dementia drug.
And now here's In Case You Haven't Heard with Francesco DeSantis.
The International Criminal Court at The Hague is preparing to hand down indictments to Israeli officials for committing war crimes. The Guardian reports the indicted are expected to include authoritarian Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Defense Minister Yoav Gallant, among others. These indictments will likely focus on Netanyahu's strategy of intentional starvation in Gaza. Yet, lest one think that the United States actually believes in the quote-unquote rules-based international order they have touted so frequently, the Biden administration will not allow these indictments to be effectuated, baselessly claiming that the ICC does not have jurisdiction in Palestine. Democracy Now! Reports State Department spokesman Vedant Patel told the press, quote, "Since this president has come into office, we have worked to reset our relationship with the ICC, and we are in contact with the court on a range of issues, including in connection to the court's important work on Darfur, on Ukraine, on Sudan, as well. But on this investigation, our position is clear. We continue to believe that the ICC does not have jurisdiction over the Palestinian situation," end quote. Former Human Rights Watch Executive Director Kenneth Roth, who has faced retribution for his past criticism of Israel, called this, quote, "the height of hypocrisy." Even as the United States shields Israel from international legal consequences for its crimes, an internal State Department memo indicates the American diplomatic corps is increasingly skeptical of the pariah state. Reuters reports, quote, "Senior U.S. officials have advised Secretary of State Antony Blinken that they do not find credible or reliable Israel's assurances that it is using U.S.-supplied weapons in accordance with international humanitarian law," end quote. This memo includes, quote, "8 examples of Israeli military actions that the officials said raise serious questions about potential violations of international humanitarian law, including repeatedly striking protected sites and civilian infrastructure, unconscionably high levels of civilian harm to military advantage, taking little action to investigate violations or to hold to account those responsible for significant civilian harm, and killing humanitarian workers and journalists at an unprecedented rate," end quote. The State Department, however, will only release a complete assessment of credibility in its May 8th report to Congress. On Tuesday, The Guardian reports an army of NYPD officers, including hundreds of armed officers in riot gear and heavy vehicles such as police buses, MRAPs, and The Bear, a ladder truck used to breach upper-story windows, stormed the campus of Columbia University and carried out mass arrests at the college's Hamilton Hall, which had been nonviolently occupied by students and renamed Heinz Hall after Han Rajab, a 6-year-old Palestinian girl murdered by the IDF. Hamilton Hall was among the buildings occupied by anti-Vietnam War protesters during the Columbia Uprising of 1968. Mayor Eric Adams used as a pretext for this militarized police action a claim that the student protests had been quote-unquote co-opted by quote-unquote outside agitators. There has been no evidence presented to support this claim. The NYPD also threatened to arrest student journalists and the Columbia Journalism School Dean Jelani Cobb, per Samantha Gross of the Boston Globe, and videos show the cops arresting legal observers and medics. Columbia University president, the Anglo-Egyptian Baroness Manush Shafiq, has requested that the NYPD continue to occupy the Morningside Heights campus until May 17th. At the University of California, Los Angeles, the New York Times reports, quote, UCLA asked for officers after a clash between pro-Palestinian demonstrators and counter-protesters grew heated overnight, end quote. This misleading report fails to clarify that, as Alejandra Caraballo of Harvard Law puts it, quote, the police stood aside and let a pro-Israeli lynch mob run wild at UCLA. They did nothing for 2 hours as violent Zionists assaulted students, launched fireworks into the encampment, and sprayed mace on students, end quote. The accompanying videos must be seen to be believed. This is yet another glaring example of media manipulation on behalf of Zionist aggression against nonviolent student protesters. In the nation's capital, a peaceful pro-Palestine encampment at the George Washington University continues to hold in the face of increasing pressure. The Washington Post reports that the university requested the D.C. Metropolitan Police Department to clear the encampment last week, but the cops demurred. The Post article cites an unnamed D.C. official who said, quote, they had flashbacks to June 2020 when images of mostly peaceful protesters being forcefully shoved out of Lafayette Square by U.S. Park Police officers with batons and chemical irritants made national news, end quote. The university has issued temporary suspensions and did attempt to clear the encampment over the weekend, but failed to do so. Now, however, congressional Republicans are heaping pressure upon the university and District of Columbia Mayor Bowser. According to the GW Hatchet, quote, Representatives Virginia Fox and James Comer, who chair the House Committee on Education and the Workforce and the Committee on Oversight and Accountability, respectively, wrote in a letter to Bowser and MPD Chief Pamela Smith that they were alarmed by the Metropolitan Police Department's reported refusal to clear the encampment, end quote, and threatened to take legislative action. Senator Tom Cotton, infamous for his New York Times op-ed calling for the deployment of the National Guard to shut down Black Lives Matter protests in 2020, sent a letter to Bowser on Tuesday writing, quote, whether it is due to incompetence or sympathy for the cause of these Hamas supporters, you are failing to protect the rights of law-abiding citizens by letting terrorist-supporting mob take over a large area of a university. Your actions are a good reminder of why Washington, D.C. must never become a state, end quote. So far, the district's leadership has exercised rare and commendable restraint. One can only hope that continues. Looking beyond individual campuses, the appeal reports over 1,400 students and staff have been arrested at, quote, protest encampments or sit-ins in more than 70 college campuses across 32 states during the past month, end quote. This piece followed up on these arrests by contacting prosecutors and city attorney's offices in every one of these jurisdictions, and found that, quote, only two offices said they would not charge people for peacefully protesting, end quote. These were, quote, Sam Bregman, the prosecutor for Bernalillo County, New Mexico, which includes the University of New Mexico's Albuquerque campus, and Matthew Van Houten, the prosecutor overseeing Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, end quote. Incredibly, this piece was published even before the recent mass arrests at Columbia and the City College of New York, which are estimated at nearly 300. Per CNN. Bringing the civil war within the Democratic Party on this issue into full view, the College Democrats of America, the official student outreach arm of the DNC, has issued a statement commending the, quote, heroic actions on the part of students for an end to the war in Palestine and for an immediate, permanent ceasefire, end quote. The statement goes on to say, quote, arresting, suspending, and evicting students without any due process is not only legally dubious, but morally reprehensible, end quote, and excoriates the White House for taking, quote, the mistaken route of a bear hug strategy for Netanyahu and a cold shoulder strategy for its own base, end quote. Noting that, quote, each day that Democrats fail to stand united for a permanent ceasefire, more and more youth find themselves disillusioned with the party. Moving beyond Palestine, hard as that is, the American prospect is out with a chilling news story on Boeing. This report documents how the late Boeing whistleblower, John Swampy Barnett, who died under deeply mysterious circumstances during his deposition against the aviation titan last month, was ignored, mocked, and harassed by his corporate overlords. When he tried to raise the alarm that Boeing's practices could be in violation of Section 38 of the United States Criminal Code, quote, the whole room burst out laughing, end quote. When he found planes riddled with defective and nonconforming parts and tried to report it, a supervisor emphatically declared, quote, we're not going to report anything to the FAA, end quote. Yet even more than Boeing's rancid corporate culture, this piece takes aim at corporate criminal law, specifically the Y2K era Air 21 law, which, quote, effectively immunizes airplane manufacturers from suffering any legal repercussions from the testimony of their own workers, quote. Per this law, quote, the exclusive legal remedy available to aviation industry whistleblowers who suffer retaliation for reporting safety violations involves filing a complaint within 90 days of the first instance of alleged retaliation with a secret court administered by the Occupational Safety and Health Administration that lacks subpoena power, takes 5 years or longer to rule in many cases, and rules against whistleblowers an astounding 97% of the time, according to the Government Accountability Project, end quote. No wonder Boeing acts as though they are above the law. United Auto Workers Union continues to rack up victories. On Tuesday, More Perfect Union reported, quote, Mercedes-Benz has abruptly replaced its U.S. CEO in an effort to undercut the union drive at Mercedes plant in Alabama. In a video shown to workers, new CEO Federico Kotlowski admits that many of you want change and promised improvements, end quote. As Jonah Furman, communications director for UAW, notes, quote, Mercedes workers have already killed two-tier wages, gotten their UAW pay bump, and fired their boss. And they haven't even voted yet. If that's what you get for just talking union, imagine what you can win when you join the union, end quote. Moreover, UAW President Sean Fain issued a statement decrying the mass arrests of anti-war protesters, writing, quote, the UAW will never support the intimidation of those exercising the right to protest, strike, or speak out against injustice. This war is wrong, and this response against students and academic workers, many of them UAW members, is wrong. If you can't take the outcry, stop supporting this war. Finally, the New York Daily News' Chris Sommerfeld reports, quote, New York City's largest cop union, the Police Benevolent Association, is suing Police Commissioner Ed Caban and Mayor Eric Adams for implementing a new zero-tolerance policy on NYPD officers using steroids or other performance-enhancing drugs, end quote. The fact that the PBA is suing this ardently pro-cop mayoral administration is alarming enough, but the fact that enough NYPD officers are using steroids to warrant this policy, and enough for the union to step in on their behalf, raises an even more alarming question. How many roid rage-fueled NYPD cops are terrorizing marginalized people on the streets of New York City? Perhaps this could explain some of the NYPD's outrageous, disproportionately violent behavior in recent years. This has been Francesco DeSantis with In Case You Haven't Heard.
And that's a wrap. Join us next week on the Ralph Nader Radio Hour. Until next time.
Stand up, stand up. You've been sitting waiting.